For What's Universal Time, stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The group of 20, the world's biggest economies, is holding meetings in China Monday after host President Xi Jinping urged resistance to pressure to raise trade barriers. In an opening speech after gaveling the session to order Sunday, Mr. Xi called for an open global economy that promotes trade and investment. He urged participants to avoid protectionist measures. He said the meeting comes at an important turning point. The U.S. presidential campaign finds the two major party candidates opposed to free trade agreements, while opposition to globalization is said to be on the rise in Europe. In Hong Kong, a new wave of anti-China activists appears headed for victory in Hong Kong legislative elections from Sunday, with a record 58% turnout, the highest level since Britain handed the territory over to China in 1997. Official results haven't yet been released. Early signs, however, point to strong support for candidates from groups that emerged from the 2014 pro-democracy street protests. South Sudan's president has agreed to accept another 4,000 regional peacekeeping troops. The decision announced after a meeting in Juba with members of the UN Security Council that included U.S. Ambassador Samantha Power, who visited a refugee camp Saturday in Juba.
Every single individual we spoke to wants to go home. And they will go home, they say, as soon as there is security. When we asked each and every one in very different circumstances, each from different parts of the country, why aren't you going home? Why are you here? The answer was not, I want the food or I want the water. It was, I'm terrified.
Mr. Kiir had resisted earlier calls for more troops. The council threatened an arms embargo unless the government cooperates. This is VOA News. Turkey's Prime Minister Binali Yildirim Sunday said Turkish-backed rebels battling Islamic State extremists on the Syrian border have driven IS fighters from their last remaining strongholds along a 90-kilometer stretch of borderland. Speaking Sunday, he said Turkish forces will retreat from Syria when Daesh, also known Islamic State, and Kurdish terrorists stop damaging our state. Turkey's direct military involvement began 10 days ago in the wake of a series of terrorist attacks. Regional analyst Anthony Billingsley of the University of New South Wales says it's too early to call it a defeat for the IS group.
Islamic State has this ability to be driven out of an area and then pop back in again. And it depends, I suppose, on how important the border area is to Islamic State.
Meanwhile, Syrian government forces and their allies laid siege to rebel-held eastern Aleppo and drove rebel elements from a military complex near the city captured a month ago. Presidents Obama and Putin are to meet Monday on the sidelines of the G20 meeting to discuss efforts to end the Syrian conflict and allow more humanitarian aid in. But Mr. Obama Sunday said both sides have grave differences in how to bring about peace in the five-year conflict. Pope Francis declared Mother Teresa a saint Sunday before tens of thousands gathered in St. Peter's Square. The Nobel laureate was known during her lifetime as the saint of the gutters for her work among the poorest of the poor in India, arriving in what is now called Kolkata in 1929.
The humanity, the way she used to love people, poor people, and everybody, it appears to me that he is already a saint. So this canonization is a process, but in our mind, she is already a saint. She is mother and saint both.
Worked here, she died here, and so mother has brought her presence, her work of love to the poorest of the poor in Calcutta.
Small of stature, the Albanian nun opened missions of charity in more than 120 countries. The case for canonization usually takes 5 years after the candidate's death, but Pope John Paul II in 2003 waived that requirement for Mother Teresa, putting her on a fast track to sainthood. The International Union for the Conservation of Nature warned Sunday the world's biggest gorillas are on the brink of extinction. Craig Hilton Taylor heads the group's red list.
The eastern gorilla has declined by more than 70% in the last 20 years because of hunting. And so that's resulted in moving from endangered into critically endangered. So that's a real cause of concern.
There are an estimated 5,000 eastern gorillas still left in the world. He said 4 of the 6 of the world's great ape species are critically endangered. But the IUCN meeting in Hawaii praised China's intense conservation program and bamboo reforestation for helping save pandas. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bungani in Washington. Today is Monday, the 5th day of September, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Sudan has agreed to the deployment of a 4,000-member regional protection force approved last month by the United Nations Security Council. The decision by President Salva Kiir, who in August rejected more peacekeepers, came a day after the 15-member Security Council visited the capital, Juba.
The presence of an intervention force is likely to put the peace process back on track. It had fallen off after Riek Machar exited Juba.
Brian Adiba is the Associate Policy Director at the ENAF Project in Washington, D.C. And Uganda is celebrating after qualifying to play in the Africa Cup of Nations next year in Gabon. The win marks the first time in over 30 years that the country will be represented at the soccer tournament. A new United Nations report warns that restrictions on freedom of expression threaten Somalia's political transition to democracy after decades of conflict and violence.
One of the key concerns is about the independence of the justice system, because it's still very much guided by clan-based politics. It also suffers from corruption. There is very limited oversight.
Cecile Puye is a spokeswoman for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. Those stories and more are coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. Facing intense international pressure, South Sudan has agreed to a 4,000-member regional protection force approved last month by the United Nations Security Council. The decision by President Salva Kiir, who in August rejected more peacekeepers, came a day after the 15-member Security Council visited the capital, Juba, to press senior officials for approval of the new force. Details of Sunday's agreement were not immediately released, and no timetable for the new deployment was announced. Brian Adiba is the Associate Director of Policy at the ENAF Project in Washington. He tells me that the new force will play an important role in protecting civilians caught in the ongoing conflict.
I think it's a positive development. I think that left to their own devices, the two protagonist factions in the South Sudanese conflict are unable to reach a peace deal. And so the presence of an intervention force is likely to put the peace process back on track. It had fallen off after Riek Machar exited Juba. So that's a positive development. However, it is very important that the UN takes into consideration the failures of the previous UN peacekeeping force in South Sudan.
There's already a peacekeeping force of 12,000, like you said. What difference would the 4,000 regional force make?
Well, the 4,000 regional force, that a 4,000-person regional force, is supposed to have a more robust mandate than the old UN peacekeeping force. Hopefully, though, it extends its jurisdiction outside the capital, because there's this presumption that the peace deal can only falter in the capital. I think that when we look at how the conflict has been unfolding across the country, the peace agreement is in tatters in almost every section of the country. So I hope that this new force will have the capacity to actually extend its mandate beyond Juba so that a holistic peace is realized in South Sudan.
Now, the two main protagonists, of obviously, as we know, was Riek Machar and President Salva Kiir. Riek Machar currently is out of the country. What can you tell us about the status of the peace agreement that was signed a couple of months ago?
Well, the peace deal allows for, you know, two separate armies, and that's the problem, actually. And so it was signed or sealed on the basis that the two opposing factions would maintain the peace. And as we have seen, that has not happened. And, of course, the other thing that the peace deal stipulates is a transitional period whereby, after 3 years, there will be elections to elect a new government that is elected by the people. But most importantly, really, when you look at the peace deal, it calls for fundamental and profound reforms in the institutions of governance in South Sudan. The peace agreement itself realizes and recognizes that the war that broke out in December 2013 was largely brought about by the absence of effective institutions functions of governance that would have mitigated the possibility of conflict. So the item in the peace deal that calls for a profound reform of the institutions of governance is really, really the most significant aspect of their peace agreement, in my opinion.
Right. Now, how hard was it for the government in Juba to agree to this force?
Well, at the beginning, it was very difficult. There was apprehension about the role of the force. The ethnic basis that forms the support base of the president was not too pleased. So there were various interests that were suspecting that the role of this force was actually regime change. And so based on that, there was a very bellicose stance that was put forth by the government and its supporters in the network of its supporters, which pronounced this resentment and opposition to the force and even saying, we're going to resist it, we're going to fight it. But that, of course, did not happen. We saw that the president himself finally came out in parliament and said any voices that are objecting to the presence of this force are doing so at their own, own inclination, and it's not the position of the government. And that was a significant shift from the earlier pronouncements that were coming out of the government and its supporters.
Now, there have been complaints among Riek Machar supporters that they've been targeted by the government on many occasions. There have many reports that have come out that accuse the government of South Sudan for having committed human rights violations. Given the mandate of this force, do you see at some point a confrontation between these two forces?
Mm-hmm. First, let me just go back to your question, assertion of Riek Machar's people accusing the government of committing human rights abuses. I think when you look at this war, both parties are guilty of egregious human rights abuses across the country. So let me just put that on the record. None of them is free of guilt. Talking of potential negative reaction or confrontation with the force, this is a war zone, and it depends on how parties react or interact with the force. Obviously, if they interact in a manner that would elicit decisive military force, I think we can say with absolute certainty that a confrontation will be likely. However, as I said, it really depends on how it interacts with the parties in the conflict, that is the government and the SPLM-IO.
Do you know of any reaction so far from Riek Machar's camp in regards to this force?
Well, Riek Machar himself has premised his return to Juba upon the return of this force. He has demanded it. So based on that, one would say that the inclination of the SPLM-IO is amenable to the presence of these 4,000 troops in Juba. Previously, back when the agreement was being drafted, of course, there were various objections to the force by both parties. But apparently right now, Machar sees the force as a means to resuscitate the almost dead agreement, I would say, that it is in the interest of the SPLM-IO. There's also a mistaken belief that the role of the force would really be to protect, the elements who are disgruntled with government. I think there's also a misperception of the role of this force among the SPLM-IO. But clearly, the force is going to enforce peace. And every side, any side that objects or obstructs peace would be liable to some action from this force.
Brian Adiba is the Associate Director of Policy at the ENAF Project in Washington, D.C. The opposition in Gabon is disputing the re-election of incumbent President Ali Bongo Ondimba. This after main opposition leader Jean Ping alleged voter irregularities and fraud. According to a new analysis by Afrobarometer, Gabon citizens are among the strongest in Africa in their support for multi-party democracy and their rejection of non-democratic alternatives. Peter Penner, the lead author of the Afrobarometer report, tells VOA's Peter Cloti that Gabon ranks near the top in favoring multi-party competition and term limits on presidents, as well as in disapproving of one party and one-man rule.
Well, what's really interesting that we see in our data and looking at Gabon and our most recent findings, we find that people are very concerned about the freeness and fairness of elections, showing that of the 36 African countries that we surveyed, Gabonese people have the lowest amount of trust in election institutions. 74% have little or no trust in their election commission. In terms of democratic beliefs, we see that in contrast to people's concerns with elections, that Gabonese, as you said, are very much embracing elections as a means of democratic governance and democracy more broadly. So those ideals are firmly in place for Gabonese people.
Well, but Peter, isn't there a discrepancy here? They don't trust the Electoral Commission to administer credible elections, yet they embrace multi-party democracy. How do they expect things to work then?
Well, that's a great point. And that's what we see, that large gap between what people really have learned to and come to think about democracy and elections, where, as you sort of alluded to, 80% of Gabonese people support multi-partyism, which, to put that in context, is second only to Ivorian in the level of support and way above the 36-country African average of 63%. So you see that far and away, that commitment to multi-partyism, and it's equally strong for democracy. So 68% of Gabonese say democracy is preferable to any form of government. And 9 in 10, you know, support, you know, term limits on the executive for president. So you see this strong impulse and support of democratic ideals. But then that gap is really widened. You know, how are elections functioning in this piece? And when we look at that, you know, the actual quality of elections, how they assess how those go in their country and historically, it's very low. And so there's that large gap. But at the same time, we see that Gabonese people haven't given up despite the fact that elections have been poorly run in their country. They haven't given up on elections.
The issue of the Bongo family having to rule nearly half a century in that country also brings kind of a question about it because Bongo Ondimba, the younger Bongo, has just been re-elected, although the election is being disputed. Why do you think there hasn't been a total rejection of this family if they think that there should be presidential term limit with power residing in one family for nearly half a century?
Well, that's a great point. So we see 9 out of 10 Gabonese, 92% supporting these two term limits in office. And that's second, again, only to Benin at 93%. So that's such a high consensus. That's a consensus position about term limits. But at the same time, as you mentioned, the Bongo family in one form or another has been in power since independence. And, you know, part of that has to do with how elections act and how elections can actually be manipulated to achieve certain outcomes. And the European Union, for example, is questioning some of the results now, and obviously the opposition is, particularly what has been going around, the figures of the 99% on turnout in the president's home era. And having been an election observer before, and you can see that, you know, vote manipulation and things of this place can actually influence outcomes. And so even though we see more regular elections in a country, in this case Gabon, that doesn't ensure that those elections will actually have a changing effect. And in fact, it's quite possible, although we don't have data or any support for this, that, you know, the results may have been one way or the other. I don't want to speculate right now. You know, there's an obvious discontent with how elections are run and a clear concern that, you know, votes aren't counted fairly, which is a big issue, and that the opposition is impeded from contesting elections openly.
Did the respondents tell you about how credible the legal structure is, or the judicial, or how independent the judicial system is to adjudicate situations of electoral dispute like we have now?
Unfortunately, we actually don't ask that question about electoral disputes. Dispute resolutions process, and I'm speaking from my own sort of expertise on election subjects, have not really yielded much different or effective results across African countries. So this bar of evidence that's required in disputes resolution is so high that very rarely do we ever see situations across African countries of disputes resolutions really addressing issues in elections. And there's a reason for that. That's because election and a lot of the malfeasance that may take place in elections is fairly well hidden from public view.
Peter Penner is the lead author of the Afrobarometer report. He spoke to VOA reporter Peter Clotty from the U.S. state of Michigan. A new United Nations report warns that restrictions on freedom of expression threaten Somalia's political transition to democracy after decades of conflict and violence. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva on the launch of the report, produced jointly by the UN Assistant Mission in Somalia and the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights.
The 48-page report documents widespread violations in Somalia against journalists, human rights defenders, and political leaders, including numerous killings, arbitrary arrests and detention, intimidation and closure of critical media outlets. Cecile Puy is spokeswoman for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. She tells VOA these targeted violations are aimed at squelching freedom of expression and critical opinion. She says Al-Shabaab rebels prohibit all journalists from operating in areas under its control and target media workers across the country. But she says federal and state security forces pose the greatest threat to media workers and political activists.
It's a key concern that remains in Somalia that journalists cannot operate more freely. And over the last 6 months, there is a new trend that seems to appear in a couple of states in Somalia, which is that journalists are being harassed in the street and physically and verbally abused by unidentified men. So we really fear that this is a danger for journalists, for freedom of expression, and for democracy at large.
Over the past 4 years, the report notes 30 journalists and 18 parliamentarians have been killed in Somalia. It also documents 120 cases of arbitrary arrest and detention of media workers between January 2014 and July 2016. Puyi says such crimes are rarely punished because Somalia's judiciary is very weak.
One of the key concerns is about the independence of the justice system because it's still very much guided by clan-based politics. It also suffers from corruption. There is very limited oversight. And as a result, there is very limited accountability for all the violations of freedom of expression.
Puyi says clan elders also are the main obstacle to women's participation in political and public life. She says the Somali government has seen the report and is taking its findings and recommendations seriously. Puyi says the UN is encouraged by this response and is urging the authorities to take quick action to ensure freedom of expression and to make Somalia a truly participatory democracy. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
There was jubilation and celebrations in Uganda after the national soccer team, the Uganda Cranes, beat rival Comoros at the Nambole Stadium in the capital, Kampala. The victory means that for the first time in over 30 years, Uganda will play at the Africa Cup of Nations. The Africa Cup of Nations will be held in Gabon next year, 2017. I reached Teddy Ruge, a social entrepreneur and analyst based in Kampala, to get his take on the meaning of this victory to Ugandans.
I've never seen the city more alive. Within 15 minutes before the game ended, I think everyone could really tell something really special was actually happening. And it's always interesting when you get into that situation and you wonder, can you actually last 15 minutes and get to the end, and is that score actually real, or are we, is something going to get snatched away from us like it's been? It seems like every time we've gotten close to qualifying, we always, something happens in the last game. Either we tie when we're supposed to win, either, we don't score enough goals. Or it's always been up to the last minute, and we've never quite crossed that line.
It's been a long time coming. I mean, you've been waiting since, what, 1979 or 1980, the last time when the country was last featured or last qualified to the Africa Cup of Nations. Is that correct?
Absolutely. It was 1978. And to give you context, Idi Amin was still president. I was with my colleagues as we were walking back because traffic was just too full on the highways. And we just basically walked a few miles getting back, and we were commenting on the fact that this time it was a clear win. It's not as if we won and then had to completely wait for the other games to finish and then pulling out our calculators to see if there was a miracle that we would actually get in. But yeah, this time it was absolutely clear. We're definitely in, and there was just nothing but pandemonium in the stadium.
Well, what is the significance of this, the Uganda Cranes actually qualifying for the African Cup of Nations?
Well, I mean, if you think about it, you know, this is from a Pan-African standpoint. I mean, it's been 30 years since anything of significance or really, really good has happened for the, you know, for the country,
mm-hmm.
In terms of putting together patriotism. If I can just give you the numbers, 70% within the 30 years, 70% of the country wasn't even born, you know. 70% of the country is under 30 years old. So this is, you know, the first major event in which they could actually go in and watch, listen on radio, and, you know, even actually watch on TV. I got a call from my mom deep in the village saying, you know, hey, the entire village was at the video hall watching the game, and the village just went crazy. It's significant in that sense. It's like it's a win of a generation.
Many of the young people who were featured on the team were not even born yet.
The last time
Uganda was at the African Cup of Nations. Are there any celebrations or national celebrations that are going to take place in the next couple of days to celebrate this big victory?
You know, I guarantee you tomorrow or Tuesday, within the next couple of days is going to be declared a national holiday. I'll be surprised if they don't call it tomorrow, because nobody's going to actually show up to work. I wouldn't be surprised if half the city's still out partying right now.
Right, Teddy, so the question is then, why did it take this long for Uganda to qualify for the Africa Cup of Nations? What happened?
You know, the thing is, quite a few factors. I mean, if you look back, I mean, we spent maybe a good half of those 30 years just trying to have political stability in which we could assemble the talent, assemble the coaches, assemble, you know, even just have the ability to travel to games, with a decent team. I think that takes a bit of time. And then also thinking about, we were talking about, the country is very young. So a lot of this talent over that time has had to grow up in a different era and in a different state. I mean, a lot of the country doesn't remember what 1978 was. And a lot of the country only has a history of having one president. So, we've had to overcome a lot more other things of critical importance. And this is where I'll give, the country a little bit of credit. Yeah, it had a lot of things to worry about, from the AIDS crisis to political instability in northern Uganda to, the education system, just infrastructure, period. That will allow the kind of luxury for pastime sport like this to actually thrive. You have to have a lot of stability in order for that to actually happen.
That is Teddy Rouge, a social entrepreneur. I reached him in the wee hours of Monday morning at his home in Kampala, Uganda. And that's it for this Monday, September 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, reporter Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clote, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a good week ahead.
Next week on Straight Talk Africa, choosing the hero, my improbable journey, and the rise of Africa's first woman president. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, the 2012 Nobel Peace Prize winner and president of Liberia, is a subject of a new book by River Levinson, an in-depth discussion on the life and career of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf is next week, right here on Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.